Good morning, I'm Robin Kelly, and this will be a systemic literature review as well as looking at some of the qualitative data that was an invitational sample that we did to really understand what was going on with integration of HIV planning groups. What I'll do is I'll tell you where I work, a little bit more about what is integration. Many of you probably know what's going on with HIV and integration and planning groups, but for those who don't, I'll go over that and some of the lessons that we're learning and continuing to gather. So again, many of you may be familiar with planning groups and with integration because it's been going on for decades. And so you're saying, like, so what about this now? Why are we beginning to go back over this? Well, there have been a lot of trends and a lot of things that are happening and a lot of activities in the field that we're beginning to see. So we wanted to really investigate more about what's going on. At first, I can't resist, if I can get this right. Oh, thank you. I first have to say that I have no relationship to disclose. But I can't resist talking about the National Minority AIDS Council, where I work, because about 27 years ago, it was birthed at this conference. At the American Public Health Association in 1986, one of the board members of the National Minority AIDS Council, or at that time, a group of participants who had formed together from various minority communities, was at APHA at a session about HIV and realized there was no person of color talking. So a gentleman named Craig Harris, the late Craig Harris, ran and rushed to the stage, grabbed the microphone and said, "I will be heard." And he began to talk about communities of color and what's going on with HIV/AIDS in those communities. So from that, the National Minority AIDS Council was birthed. So again, we're 27 years ago. We celebrated back again in Vegas a couple of years ago. The National Minority AIDS Council is funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and this is the Capacity Building Assistance Provider staff. CDC funds a portion of it, that's our CBA staff members, to do work with community-based organizations nationwide, as well as health departments nationwide and their planning groups. But you all knew that. So again, the purpose of this presentation will be an overview of how the Global Fund of HIV/AIDS to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria includes civil society, and how that civil society sort of looks at what we're doing when we look at planning groups nationwide, our civil society, our planning group members. We're going to look at really something called transformational change. It's a little different than transitional change or developmental change, and why we're looking at an era now where transformational change is so key, and many people are not sure what that means, what to do, and what's going to happen next. So again, the goal is to really better understand the reality of the planning body integration and the lessons that they've learned and how it can aid the planning group members moving forward and how that's sort of similar to what's going on with civil society groups through the Global Fund. We're also going to specifically define at least one lesson learned from the integration of HIV prevention from planning groups. And I'm going to explain how community engagement can factor into decision-making for HIV/AIDS prevention, care, and treatment in the U.S. and HIV/AIDS public health system. So civil society. If we look at the Global Fund to fight AIDS, malaria, and TB, we really realize that it really includes everyone. It includes people who are funders, but it also includes people who are from the developed world and the non-developed world, the stakeholders, the people who are living with and affected by the diseases. In fact, of the voting members, there is allocated spaces and seats. So we switch to the United States, and particularly our system of healthcare, and how we have a planning body that helps to make decisions, conscious decisions, about what to do to prepare to develop a plan for HIV/AIDS in various communities. This is an HIV planning group, and CDC is really one of the major funders of that planning group through health departments. But you also have, within health departments, a planning council, and that council is usually funded by HRSA, the Human Resources Services Administration, and HRSA is a group that really would take the planning council and have them really allocate or look at funding and also, you know, in what ways can care and treatment be best and efficiently provided. So you have many people who are working together, but as you see, they may speak or think a little differently. So you may have more passion, you may have more color, you may have more flavor when you have people in the planning group. And you may have more people who realize, well, the bottom line is, how much will this cost? on the Planning Council. So when you think about integration, you're thinking about really merging people who have dollar signs and money as their bottom line and important factors that they need to consider with people who are really thinking about their community, really thinking about themselves. They are thinking about people who they represent who are really out there to help them survive. But there are similarities. You know, at the end of the day, it's about serving clients. If you look at the Global Fund, it's about making a difference. They have coordinated country coordinating mechanisms on the ground who really go out, who really represent their populations. We have people, again, the planning groups who really represent populations, and even the planning council members. Many of them are allocated members who are representing the disease personally, as well as certain groups. So you really have a lot of similarities. Now, if we think about integration, we're seeing more and more similarities between planning groups and planning councils in the United States. But there has been a strong motivator for change. They just didn't arrive at this point because they thought about their clients only. Many do, but it's a hard process to integrate. Again, you're going back with someone who only sees and is trained to see the bottom line, the financial figures, and what they can do to be most efficient and effective. With those who really are more process-driven and those who really who have been thinking and planning and working with their community. So although many groups have integrated since the 90s, a lot have not. Now they're beginning to realize they have to do that. There is a motivator for change. This motivator is transformational. It's something that requires a new mindset, new behavior, even new cultures to think about what are you doing in this new era where you have a totally different healthcare type of system? What do you do when you have something as a strategy known as the National HIV/AIDS Strategy? What do you do when you find that your funders, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and HRSA, have released a letter saying, hey, we need to integrate more? So if you've been used to if groups have been used to planning for since the councils really began in the 90s, doing things one way, and now they're being asked to do something different, how is that going to happen that's effective? So they needed a little motivator. So one of the main, again, motivators was the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, or NHOS. There are four goals of NHOS, but the most important one that led to the integration is number four, which is to achieve a coordinated national response to HIV/AIDS epidemic. So that we can look at when we think about what's been going on with the 12 Cities Project. As many of you all may know, there was a funding announcement called the ECHIPS Funding Announcement Enhanced. I have to read that one because I was getting messed up. But enhanced opportunity for funding allowed people to, enhanced comprehensive HIV prevention planning and implementation for metropolitan statistical areas most affected by HIV/AIDS. When that funding was released, they looked at really the most targeted cities across the United States that had the highest rates for HIV/AIDS. So from that, they also said, well, at this time, we have these opportunities to really see how we can integrate, how services can be brought together in a more systematic way that really brings people and resources into communities. So that became known as the 12 Cities Project. So NMAC's role in integration, we weren't funding the 12 Cities Project, we weren't funding or working with ECHIPS. But what we were doing was we were trying to work with the community-based organizations that were on the ground, we were trying to work with the health groups, the planning groups, to see what they were doing. We've developed different types of programming. We've developed something called the Strengthening Community Leaders that are influencing change to help them understand what's going on. But to do that, we really had to dig deeper. We had to really find out about integration. We had to learn a little bit more. So we saw that there were current trends. I think this is animation. Okay. That really, you know, engagement of stakeholders was key. It was necessary. Everyone had to be at the table. That meant that not only could they sit there, but we had to really find out how they would get involved. What would they bring? We had to look at care and what that meant for certain populations and groups, and finally how you defined prevention for other groups. So we saw, again, integration is not new, but we began to dig deeper and found out that a trend began towards collaboration of integrated care and planning, that the reasons for that really included the that over half the country was currently integrated. We had about 28 states of the 65, not quite half, but 65 jurisdictional areas that 28 of those are integrated. A lot of those happen to be in areas that are not in the urban centers. So we began to see and poke around to find out why. We even began to ask, what does integration mean for you all? Because it means different things. Some people meant, for them, they meant collaborating on joint projects, but still remaining separate. For others, they meant sharing planning products, but still remaining separate. Sometimes they meant sharing members, but then you didn't really have what we thought about as full integration. So we're looking at resource consolidation. We're looking at integration of care and engaging stakeholders. So to really best assist our constituents, we wanted to find out what is integration. And again, we sort of did a sample. As I said, it was a qualitative sample, invitational sample, where we went and asked in-depth questions of about six, really. I listed five here, but six organizations, six jurisdictions. We asked not only the planning group, but also the health department staff person. We asked them about why they did integrate, if they did, and for those who didn't or had problems integrating, why were there problems? What were the barriers? What was going on? If you all can't see this, please let me know, and I can sort of get some information to you later on. But merging was a successful thing that did happen for some of the groups, but it really took time. It was not a fast operation. It took time. We had one group that really came to us to assist with their integration project, and it did not work out. One of the main reasons that it did not work was because it was on a timetable that one person set without the collaboration and invitation of others. It took time. It took buy-in. It took understanding. It took people to really make a concerted effort to continue to work through it. One of the things that we learned was that people needed to listen to one another. You really had to engage the community, not just the community representative. And it needed to be transparency. Trust had been an issue. You know, can I really trust this person to do what he or she says? Well, what does this mean? In 2012, there was a new funding announcement for health departments. And with that funding announcement, health departments had to restructure themselves a little differently, as well as their planning groups. So that really affected many people's, particularly planning groups, view of trust. Can they trust the health departments? They're changing the ways we're doing things now. What does this mean for us? As you see, there were more challenges with integration. There really were... if people continue to work through them, they hadn't really been able to identify a number of successes. They really felt that at the end of the day it was beneficial, but they realized that it really determined close planning, a lot of resources, a lot of commitment, a lot of support. One lesson learned was that they thought it was evolutionary, it was transformational. Again, a different mindset, a different behavior, and different culture had to exist. It was transformational. It wasn't just changing one or two things, it was transformational. So as it evolved and they grew, they looked at barriers, but they found solutions, so they thought they'd try it. So another lesson learned was to start fresh with new planning group members and finally to get assistance support from others, from states, from capacity building assistance providers. So what is integration? The sharing, merging, or integration of states, HIV planning groups, collaboration of joint projects, sharing products, sharing members. This is all that we heard that people have said. They're working towards the goal. For many, it's still an ongoing process. They had to make decisions. They had to go back to make decisions. They had to think about how do you not duplicate efforts but still keep members engaged. For some members, it was beneficial. They didn't have to attend two meetings. They could just do one. But they did have to, you know, sacrifice some of the membership. Some didn't want to come to just one. They had to benefit from sharing knowledge. Another reason to begin to integrate was to increase collaboration and communication, to save money by sharing resources. So there are a lot of challenges: mistrust, bias, different languages. That was a big issue. The planning group speaks one language. The planning council may speak another. So even having a dictionary was recommended as a resource or a tool. Again, uncertainty, resentment, power struggles. If you had money and now you're giving it up, or you're merging with someone who doesn't, or a group that operates a different way, it really made a difference. So We are still ongoing in this process. We're committed to it, and we want to finish it. But we began to do the systemic literature review to begin to understand really what had been out there and what has been going on. A lot has been going on. A lot is out there. But a lot more needs to be done. We only have about 28 of the 65 jurisdictions who are, or even say they're integrated. And again, the definition is out there as well. It means so many things for so many different people. But as ZMAC is committed to going on with that, we hope that you would join us for the ride. Thank you.
Please join me again in thanking all of our presenters. And now we have a few minutes where we can take questions for any of our individuals on the panel. Please, sir.
How were the barbers recruited, and what is the compensation or incentive that they're getting for participating in the program?
Okay. Well, we choose barbershops first, and then we approach the barbers and see which ones are actually interested in participating in the program. They're compensated $20 per haircut, because that's typically how much a haircut costs. They get additional money for doing the intervention, but it's just $5 additional. So $25 on the 2 intervention days, and then $20 for follow-up sessions.
Yes, ma'am.
I actually have a question for the project in the Dominican Republic. You didn't recruit the couples into the study, but then you did have some male sex partners and a female sex worker. So if a female sex worker referred her partner, she would not have participated in the study. So they were unmatched pairs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, the women who may have referred their partners, they still weren't eligible. We just didn't make any distinction.
Okay.
So technically possible if there was a man and a woman who were partnered, but we didn't know about it.
Yes, sir.
Obviously, it's a very complex issue to even say the word stigma means so many different things. But as far as the kind of comparison that I was making there, it was mainly that the providers were saying, I think that, you know, sometimes people aren't staying in care, remaining in care because of stigma. However, when it was directly asked, as far as the questions that you had seen there, the phrasing of, you know, has this ever been a barrier of care for you to not make an appointment, it was rated relatively low. However, you know, things like the employer and things like that were more of a free response answer of, is there anything else you want me to know, or is there something else that, you know, we haven't listed here that you feel is something. And so there definitely can be stigma kind of nestled in some of the different aspects of what people had claimed. A lot of those were for the question of there's been this gap that you haven't been in care, what was the reason for that? And sometimes it was close to 2 weeks to a month and a half, and they were saying that those types of reasons could have caused the gap. So that was kind of their fill-in-the-blank answer. But I didn't necessarily look at each individual free response, because that was more of the qualitative, what do you think? But that's a really good point, that there is stigma sort of hidden in a lot of those different free response answers. But when it was directly asked, it was rated relatively low on any of the stigma section on how that was asked. Patients did not seem to feel like that was a reason that they would not remain in care. But that's a really good point. I appreciate your comment.
Yes.
Okay,
to follow up on that, I know it was low literacy. Do you think they understood what stigma really means? I think that they inferred stigma, but when you ask stigma within a population that may not know the definition, they may rate it low. Because, I mean, we
we know that it's a part of what we do with stigma. So I'm thinking they didn't understand the word more so than anything, because too many things went back to stigma.
Mm-hmm.
So you might even, like, if you do it again, try with maybe not using stigma, because we never use it because they don't understand it. We don't use MSM because that's the term that we use versus what the population actually uses.
So it was more like that was the stigma section of the survey versus the fact that we were necessarily saying, do you feel stigma? Do you not feel stigma? So there was kind of different ways of asking that as far as, you know, do you feel that you could reveal your status to individuals like your family and friends and how, you know, that kind of thing. Have you felt like this judgment from other individuals? So sometimes it would be that people would say, you mean, you know, that I'm judged by others and that kind of thing. So that's a good point, though, that it wasn't necessarily stated as do you feel stigma. It was more so trying to, that was the kind of section of the questionnaire that I was referencing more so. So there are two questions that I referenced that do have the word stigma, but most of them were trying to assess it without saying that word. But, and it was clarified anytime someone, you know, said, what does that mean? Because that did happen. Yeah.
In the red, and then back.
I have a question for Sierra. So, were there any barriers to this intervention? I'm curious about whether Barbara's reported losing clients that didn't want to be, you know, engaged in this way, or didn't want to even be asked to participate. Did they turn anybody off? Were they shopping for new barbers?
No, I don't think the barrier was losing participants because the lack of interest. I think barriers that it's a very transient population. Because our population is between the ages of 18 and 24, and African American, we had a lot of individuals who are either incarcerated or some that even went away to college. So that was hard to retain them. But other than that, we didn't have any barriers with participants not being interested in participating.
Yes, sir.
This is kind of a related question. I'm not sure if you meant this as well, but in terms of recruiting the actual barbers, barbershops, did you have resistance there? And if so, what were some of the reasons that the shop owners might have said, no, I'm not interested?
Absolutely. I think the culture of each barbershop is different. Some barbershops were more involved in their community, and those were the barbershops that were willing to participate. Other barbershops were a little more private. Some were religious and didn't want a special program in their barbershop. And because barbers are basically like entrepreneurs that make their own schedule, they didn't want us invading their space or telling them how to run their day, and they didn't want to lose out on other clients. Because when we do come in, we ask that the barbershop is closed for that day. And even though we typically run the program on a Monday, when a barbershop is closed, that's their personal day to handle their business. So we did receive some resistance and barriers in recruiting barbershops with that, but it's gone well. We had 41, 48 is our target. We're almost finished.
For the Open Arms Clinic, that is a phenomenal program that you guys have designed. You may have already considered it, but I'm thinking for funding, you're set up for a really nice R01, even as a natural experiment to compare what you're doing to maybe a provider that is not LGBTI friendly or sensitive, to sort of see what the difference is that you can make on some psychological factors, you know, social demographic issues. So have you considered either applying for grant funding with this or continuing to do research, like you did the research to found it, and then using that as a way to sustain yourself?
Well, yes, we're always looking for funding opportunities. We have a couple that we are currently working on, so that's something that we have already taken into consideration. But prior to the opening of the clinic, we didn't have any funding available, so we just used the resources that we had already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
So at Oregon, you got this comment for Ron's in your presentation. I just wanted to say that I think that it's very interesting, and I think it's a really great thing to support that integration. And it, you know, for each shift, that was something that the thing I wanted to underscore was the way you described people informing the community and the participants, and the each of participants that were most successful with that really did the best job of incorporating community feedback and community input to the process, and also had a big, part of it is an ongoing relationship, but part of it is with this new effort, what do you do now, how do you frame it, and the most successful ones framed it with the community, but you know, it's not because we we have to do this, because that is one of the reasons. I mean, that you don't actually, it's not actually required to do this, but it's being promoted, right? It's the reason that I think helps a lot of this conversation. You mentioned evolution also, that this is like kind of the next step to be able to provide better service in a community or a jurisdiction level. And so I really applaud that working, and I know it's not over. It's a lot more to do with it. Thank you.
I think we have time for maybe two more questions. Yes, so then and then.
So I went to the first one to ask two questions already. I had the opportunity to attend the Blocks training, Amex Blocks training, which was great, and but was directed at executive directors of CBOs and those. Is there any plan of doing some sort of transformational leadership technical assistance for CABs and planning councils so that the actual members could have some of that training that we got in the Blocks program?
Thank you for that. The BLOCK stands for Building Leadership for Organizational Change and Sustainability, the program that the National Minority Youth Council launched. And we have done some, we are launching training for the leadership of planning groups. It's not a BLOCK,
okay.
But it will be something that helps to strengthen our community leadership in the influencing change.
Yes.
Hi, Mike Schenkel with Health Activities for the barbershop, I figure. I wanted to know about the sustainability of this model beyond this pilot, because when you think about barbershops having to close for a day or having them come in on a day that they're not working, what is the sustainability in the practice for them?
I mean, I guess. I guess we'll see. Maybe Dr. Baker can speak more.
That's a great question. And I think when the whole research team designed the intervention, that was actually one of the things that we thought about in the beginning. Versus oftentimes you think about that at the end, like, oh, well, what can we do to make this actual research program sustainable? Because initially when we wrote the grant and we did the focus group. The original intervention was going to be a one-on-one intervention, and then when we did additional interviews and focus groups, the young men said, no, we'd rather have a group setting, and the barbershop owners that we talked to were very excited and very pumped up. But then, you know, once you get to the actual, research part and really getting into the culture of the barbershop, because all of us have worked in the barbershop, Dr. Brawner, Dr. Stewart, myself, Ciara, we get there working in the shop, and it's like Ciara beautifully said, it really is a culture to itself. These are the owners are, this is their business, and again, we've had owners who have both opened their arms and let us in, and some who haven't. So maybe, we have to figure out if there's, another way to make the intervention once it's done maybe in a different format, for the actual barbershop. Because it's time intensive, like Ciara said, when we have an intervention day at the barbershop, it's 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock p.m., and we're shutting down the shop. That's not going to happen once this project is over.
So we sort of, even when we try to do research in a real-world setting, it's never really truly, there's always the artifact piece that's brought in. So the nice thing is once it's developed and it's evidence-based and we can show that it works, they can then take it and adapt it for however it best meets their needs. So they would have the product to then say, okay, as I'm cutting my clients here, this is the conversation that I can have. So, we develop it in partnership with them to find a way that it can work, but then it's at the end on the ground, it doesn't roll out exactly as we had expected, they still have a product that they can use to meet their needs.
Right. And one thing that the barbershop owner, because the model for the barbershop intervention is very similar to Dr. Jamont's sister intervention that I have done with the one-on-one intervention. And so once it was all said and done, sister perfected, and hopefully barbershop will be as well. Now a lot of the clinics just use the video in the waiting room, and that's okay because we already know the perspective, they can do whatever they want to do with the product. So I can definitely see that these awesome videos, which are amazing, because most of the barbershops have TVs. So they may not use the iPads. We're not giving them when you show the video, and you, I mean, they're already having conversations.
And they can have the conversation that continue.
All these videos are just another way to get the information out there to have these conversations with the young men. So I think once it's done, that's probably something that would happen. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So, thank on behalf of those presenters, I just want to thank each one of you all for being here. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Right.